You are listening to the podcast of Providence Church in Austin, Texas. We hope this message raises your affections for Jesus and helps you live out the gospel in everyday life.
There is, I think, something in us as human beings that understands the gravity of swearing an oath, the power of making a vow. When we go to a wedding ceremony, the most solemn part of the ceremony is the vows. That's when everybody pays close attention, because that's when the couple is making promises. That's when they're getting married, actually. At a presidential inauguration, the new president swears an oath to faithfully execute the office of President of the United States. When someone is testifying in a court of law, they swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And if they don't do that, they could be charged with perjury for breaking that oath. Even little kids understand the power of swearing an oath. When I was little, we had like the pinky swear, and then if you wanted to step it up a little bit, there was the blood oath, where you and your friend would take a pocket knife and cut your hand a little bit and shake hands and mingle your blood, and that was intense. And if you wanted to get a little more intense than that, you would swear on your mother's life, right? Mom, I never did that, if you're listening to the podcast. And then there was the big dog, swearing to God. When I was little, I had a friend who would always say, "I swear to God, I swear to God." And it was just about stupid stuff. And every time he did that, I kind of winced a little bit. Because I was taught, hey, you don't swear to God like that. If you don't mean it, you might be taking the Lord's name in vain. And I sense that this is a big deal, to swear to God. There's something in us that understands the power and the gravity of swearing an oath. It's a really big deal. And the reason I bring that up is because this psalm today is structured around, you heard it, two different oaths. In the first half of the psalm, David swears an oath to God. He makes a vow to God. You see that in verse 2. Look at it. It's right there at the beginning in verse 2. That's a big deal, making a promise to God like that. But then in the second half of the psalm, God swears an oath to David, which you see right there in verse 11. And that's an even bigger deal, when God makes a promise to you. And so here's how the psalm breaks down. The first half of the psalm, verses 1 through 10, are essentially a prayer of the people. And the prayer is related to David's oath. Then the second half of the psalm, verses 11 through 18, is a response from God. It's a promise from God based on God's oath. Now, as we said, this is one of the songs of ascent, which we've been looking at this summer. We've said again and again that the Israelites would sing these songs as they ascended up to Jerusalem three times a year to worship in one of the festivals at the temple. And this song, in many ways, is a reenactment of some of the events in King David's life, specifically the events found in 2 Samuel chapter 6 and 2 Samuel chapter 7. You can read about them, this kind of rehearses that narrative. So in 2 Samuel 6, David brings the ark up to Jerusalem, just like the pilgrims singing this song are going up to Jerusalem, maybe on the same road that the ark traveled. In 2 Samuel chapter 7, the next chapter, God makes this incredible promise to David. He makes a covenant with David, which has implications for all of history, which has implications for the whole world. And so the two parts of this psalm map onto the two parts of that narrative, right, which we're going to see. Psalm 132 gives God's people a chance to sing a prayer based on David's oath to God, and then to hear God's promises in response, based on God's oath to David. So the prayer of the people and the promises of God, that's what we're gonna look at today, okay? And here's what we're gonna see. God's promises far exceed the people's prayers. His promises are greater than even the things that they pray for, because that's how God is. His promises are greater than our prayers, right? He's able to do immeasurably more than all that we ask or imagine, it says in Ephesians 3. So let's look first at the prayer of the people based on David's oath to God. Look at verse 1. Verse 1. Remember, O Lord. So the prayer begins with the word remember. Remember, O Lord, in David's favor, all the hardships he endured. You could word this more simply as, Lord, remember David, right? So from the outset of the prayer, they're appealing to David's name, to David's standing with God. They're praying, Lord, remember David, and in doing so, remember us, because we're identified with him. David is our representative. It's like they're praying in David's name, so to speak. I don't mean that irreverently, but that's what they're doing. He's the basis for their prayer. Now, look at it. First five verses. Remember David, Lord. Verse 2, how he swore to the Lord and vowed to the mighty one of Jacob. And here comes the oath. It's in quotes. This was David's vow. I will not enter my house or get into my bed. I will not give sleep to my eyes or slumber to my eyelids until I find a place for the Lord, until I find a dwelling place for the mighty one of Jacob. And so the key word here is place. David's oath is about finding a place for God, a home for God. That's what he's committed to. He's like, I'm not going to sleep until I get this thing done, right? Which doesn't mean he's going to pull hundreds of all-nighters until he builds a temple for the Lord. It's an expression that, hey, I won't rest until God has a home. Now, this is likely referring to the beginning of 2 Samuel chapter 7, where David had it in his mind to build a temple for God. David had come to Jerusalem. He had settled in Jerusalem in his sweet palace. It says it was this beautiful house of cedar. But then he looked around and he was like, hey, God is living out in a tent. God is living out in the tabernacle, which was a movable tent, a movable place of worship. And he's like, that doesn't seem right for me to be living in this awesome house and God is living in a tent. That's not how it should be. So he resolved to build a permanent house for God, a temple. Now, of course, David knew that God doesn't live in a literal house. He knew that the God of the universe can't be contained in a temple or in a tabernacle. You can't box God in. David knew that. In fact, in Psalm 139, David says this, God, where can I go from your spirit? Where can I go? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you're there. If I make my bed in the depths, you're there. So David knew that God is everywhere. And yet at the same time, David also knew that God had graciously chosen a place to make his presence known, to make himself known to his people in a particular place. The universal God made himself local, right? He had chosen Jerusalem as his dwelling place. It says that in verse 13. I chose Jerusalem. It says Zion in verse 13. That's just the city of Jerusalem here, right? And there in Jerusalem, at the temple, the universal God would make himself accessible to his people. You could know that God was there. You could meet with God there in that particular place, in the temple in Jerusalem. But as we move forward in the psalm, in verses 6 through 8, we're going to see that the presence of God had an even more precise location, right? The psalm zooms in even closer in verses 6 through 8. And one illustration that I heard about this said that it's kind of like Google Earth. I don't know if you've ever gone on Google Earth. You pull it up, and it's on the screen. It's an image of the whole world, the whole Earth on your screen. And you can search for your address. And when you type in your address, it quickly starts to zoom. It zooms in on your continent, then on your country, then on your state, then on your city, then on your neighborhood, then on your house. And then you can type, then you can hit Street View, and all of a sudden you're staring at your front door, like in a matter of seconds. It's a little spooky, honestly, right? It zooms in very quickly. Psalm 132 is Google Earthing us to God's dwelling place, to God's presence. It starts in the city of Jerusalem, where David is, and then it zooms in closer to the temple as David vows in verses 1 through 5 to build a temple. And now it zooms in even more. Look at verse 6. Behold, we heard of it in Ephrathah. We found it in the fields of Jaar. Let us go to his dwelling place. Let us worship at his footstool. Arise, O Lord, and go to your resting place. You and the ark of your might. They heard of it in Ephrathah. They found it in the fields of Jar. What is it? Well, according to verse 8, it is the ark of God's might. It's the ark of the covenant. Now, if you know anything about the ark of the covenant, you know it was a large wooden box covered in gold, and in it were the tablets with God's law, the stone tablets with God's law on them. It was constructed under Moses way back in Exodus. And the lid of the ark was called the mercy seat. It was made of solid gold. And there on the lid of the ark, there on the mercy seat, once a year on the Day of Atonement, the high priest would go into the Holy of Holies, the most holy place in the tabernacle, where the ark stayed, and he would sprinkle blood on the mercy seat to atone for the sins of the people. So the ark was the symbol of God's presence among his people. But more than that, it was the focal point for his mercy, for his forgiveness, for his atonement that he offered his people. And so the psalmist is zooming into God's presence from Jerusalem to the temple to the ark. And there on the mercy seat, God made himself accessible. God made his presence known. He wasn't confined to the box. He wasn't trapped in the box, but he made himself known there graciously. Verse 7 calls the ark his footstool, his dwelling place. So wherever the ark was holy ground. It was a big deal. But did you notice what happened to it in verse 6? Look at verse 6. Verse 6 says, we heard of it in Ephrathah. We found it in the fields of Jar. So evidently, they had misplaced the ark. It really was the lost ark, right? They had to go find it. They didn't know where it was for a time. See, the ark of God had moved around since it was built. It moved around with the people of God since the days of Moses. Like, it was central to their community, where they would follow the ark because that was God's presence, and it would always be at the center of their community. But the ark had ended up in a place called Kiriath-Jearim. In verse 6, it's called the fields of Jar. Jar is singular for Jearim. 1 Samuel chapter 7, verse 2 tells us that the ark had been in Kiriath-Jearim for 20 years. Think about that. It's a long time, 20 years. My youngest daughter is 18 years old. She's going to college in a couple of weeks. So for 2 years longer than her entire life, the ark went missing and was basically forgotten by the community. Like, the symbol of God's presence at the heart of the community, the mercy seat where sin was atoned for, went missing for 20 years and nobody seemed to even notice. Pastor David Strain says that this is the epitome of spiritual drift. I think that's a great observation for us to consider. Like, the symbol of God's presence was removed from the community and the people just kind of slowly forgot about it over years. It wasn't all of a sudden. It was a spiritual drift to the point that the people simply didn't even notice the absence of God's presence. They were probably still going through all the religious motions in their life, but they didn't notice that the place of God's presence was missing from their community. I wonder if we could ever get to that point where we come here and do church, sing the songs, pray the prayers, listen to the sermons. But what if God wasn't with us? Would we even notice? Would we ever get to the point where we wouldn't even notice the absence of his presence? David Strain says, beware of slow, imperceptible drift. Doesn't happen quickly, slowly. He says, beware of bare formal religion that has the appearance of godliness, but denies its power. See, what we need most in life is not religious activity. We need the presence of God, which King David knew. So after 20 years, thankfully, he went and got the ark at Kiriath-Jearim. And he brought it to Jerusalem. You can read about that in 2 Samuel chapter 6. It was a party. The people brought the ark up to Jerusalem with great rejoicing and dancing. They were partying along the way because God's presence was being restored to the heart of the community. And now this prayer in Psalm 132 rehearses that scene. Like, it gives the pilgrims traveling up to Jerusalem the chance to express their desire to come into God's presence, their need to come into God's presence. Look at verse 8. Here's the prayer. Arise, O Lord, and go to your resting place. You know, whenever the ark would set out in the wilderness, and when Moses was leading them, this is what the people would pray. They would pray, arise, O Lord, lead us. And then they pray in verse 9, let your priest be clothed with righteousness. Let our spiritual leaders be actually righteous, godly. And let your saints, that's all of us, shout for joy. And then they pray in verse 10, for the sake of your servant David. So again, they're praying in David's name. For the sake of your servant David, do not turn away the face of your anointed one. In other words, Lord, let your anointed king, whoever happens to be king on the throne at that time, let them come into your presence on the basis of your covenant with David. Let all of us come into your presence on the basis of your covenant with David. That's what we need most. We need your presence. So it's a prayer for access. And we're just like them. Like, we need God's presence more than anything else in the world. And the good news of the gospel is that we have it. We have it in Jesus. We can come into God's presence, not based on who David is, but based on who Jesus is, his great descendant. Jesus is the dwelling place of God. John 1, verse 14, the Word, who is God, became flesh and made his dwelling among us. He tabernacled among us. Jesus is also the mercy seat, the place where sin is atoned for. It says it in Romans 3, verse 25. God presented Christ as a sacrifice of atonement through the shedding of his blood. That phrase, sacrifice of atonement, in Romans 3, 25, is the word for mercy seat. It's the exact same word. Jesus is the mercy seat. So when we zoom into the person of Jesus, we find the presence of God, and we find the place of forgiveness. So this prayer, Psalm 132, it's for us. It's for us. And we pray it with Jesus in mind. Now, that's the prayer of the people. Let's look at the promises of God based on God's oath to David. I think God's like, hey, y'all impressed with David's oath to me? You thought that was pretty great? Well, listen to my oath to David. I want you to hear what I promise him. You see it there in verses 11 and 12. This is God's oath. Verse 11. The Lord swore to David a sure oath from which he will not turn back. And here's the oath in quotes again. One of the sons of your body, David, I will set on your throne. If your sons keep my covenant and my testimonies that I shall teach them, their sons also forever shall sit on your throne. Now, this is basically a summary of the covenant that God makes with David in 2 Samuel chapter 7. You can read about it. Basically, there in 2 Samuel chapter 7, God says to David, hey, you're not gonna build me a house. I'm gonna build you a house, right? You're not gonna find a place for me to rest. I'm gonna find a place for you in Israel to rest. And then, David, I'm gonna give you a son. His name is gonna be Solomon. And Solomon is gonna build the temple that you wanted to build. And Solomon's gonna do a great job with that. He'll take care of it. But most importantly, David, I want you to know that your house and your kingdom will endure before me forever. Your throne, David, will be established forever. And so basically God says, hey, David, I'll see your oath, and then I'll raise it like a billion times, right? I hear what you're saying, but this is what I'm gonna do. Derek Kidner comments on this in his usual understated way, which I love. He says, it was a typically divine response to a well-meaning gesture to refuse a perishable house and bestow an imperishable one. In other words, isn't that so, God? to do that. Isn't it so God to say, David, hey, I appreciate your oath. Really, I do. But I don't need you to take care of me. I'll take care of you. I'm God. And listen, I don't think God is showing David up here. I think he loves David's commitment. But I think it's kind of like when your five-year-old wants to give you something for Christmas, and they go and find something in your house that you already own, and then they wrap it poorly and put it under the Christmas tree, right? When you open that gift on Christmas morning, you're not like, what a joke. This is already mine. You don't say that. No, you say, I love it. I love it. Thank you, sweetie. This is awesome. It's exactly what I wanted. And you mean it. You mean it. And then you say, now, here are your 25 presents that I took out a second mortgage to buy. Enjoy them. And you mean it, right? You're not showing up your kid. You're not trying to one-up your child. You're just being their father. You got the resources, not them. God is saying, David, your oath is honorable, but my oath will change the world because I'm God. Now, if David's oath was primarily about a place, I think God's oath is primarily about a person. Like, David, I'm going to raise up one person from your descendants, and all my promises will be realized through that person. We see his promises start to unfold in the last part of the psalm. I want you to notice how the promises of God in the second half of the psalm correspond to the prayers of the people from the first half of the psalm, only God's promises go above and beyond what they prayed for. It's great. So for example, if you look at verse 8, the people prayed, "Arise, O Lord, and go to your resting place." Then God responds in verse 14 by promising, "Jerusalem is my resting place forever," meaning, you want presents? I'll give you my forever presence. So his promise is bigger than their prayer. He adds to it in verse 15 by saying, I will abundantly bless her, bless Jerusalem, her provisions. I'll satisfy her poor with bread. So not only will I give you my forever presence, I'll give you forever provisions. His promise is bigger than their prayer. In the first half of verse 9, they pray, Lord, let your priest be clothed with righteousness. And he answers them exactly in verse 16, but he expands it. He says, her priests I will clothe with salvation, which is more expansive than just righteousness. His promise is bigger than their prayer. The second half of verse 9, they pray, let your saints shout for joy. But in verse 16, God promises her saints will shout with great joy or forever joy. That word in verse 16 is actually amplified, because his promises are bigger than our prayers. And so I gotta believe that the pilgrims traveling up to Jerusalem, singing this song, were just brimming with anticipation. Because everything they prayed, God answers with, I will, I will, I will, I will. Did you notice that in the second half of the psalm? It's all future tense. I will, I will. I will. Well, when, God? When will you? When will you fulfill these promises? Well, it wasn't going to be totally realized in David's day. It wasn't going to be fully realized in his son Solomon's day. Solomon actually kind of started to drift from the Lord at the end of his life. And then when the kingdom was under Solomon's son, the kingdom split into two, which was a tragedy. And then most of the kings after that fall into sin and idolatry, and they drag the people right along with them into sin and idolatry. And eventually, the nation is conquered. The people are taken into exile. Jerusalem is destroyed. The temple is destroyed. And it looks like the Davidic dynasty, David's dynasty, is over. And we're left thinking, hey, what happened to God's I will, I will, I will? How will your promises ever be realized? And the answer is found in the last two verses of the psalm. I love this. All of God's promises will be realized through one person, and he's described in verse 17 and 18. Look at it. verse 17 and 18. God says, there I will make a horn to sprout for David. I'll give David a horn. And then he says, I've prepared a lamp for my anointed. I've prepared a lamp for David. His enemies I will clothe with shame, but on him his crown will shine. And so out of David's descendants, one son will arise who will be different than all the rest of them. And look how he's described here. It says he'll be a horn, a sprouting horn. That's a weird metaphor for us, a weird image for us. But in those days, it made total sense. In those days, they knew that a horn was a symbol of strength and power. It's like the horn of a mighty animal. Every July in Pamplona, Spain, they have the running of the bulls. It's like a crazy, scary, adrenaline-inducing event. But what makes it scary is not just running down the street with large, powerful animals. What really makes it scary is the horns, right? That can gore you. That can pick you up and throw you over a wall. The horns are the scary part. Without the horns, right, it's just like, it'd be like just like the running of the cows, which is way less intimidating, right? Like a horn is a sign of power and strength. And this son of David will be a strong, powerful ruler. It also says he'll be a lamp. Did you know that the lamp in the temple never went out? They didn't allow it to go out. It was to be this perpetual light that symbolized, signified God's faithful, guiding, illuminating presence. And this says that this son of David will be a lamp illuminating, guiding his people. He'll be a light in revelation to the whole world. And then finally, it says his crown will shine. So he'll have a crown, he'll be a king, and his crown will never lose its luster. Like the glory of his kingdom will be unfading. That word shine there is really the word blossom. His crown will blossom. It will flourish, meaning his government will grow, extend, bear fruit everywhere. Now, obviously, from our vantage point, we know who this is talking about as David's one son through whom the promises would be fulfilled. It's talking about Jesus Christ, right? Jesus is the strong, powerful ruler. He's the horn. He's the King of kings and Lord of lords. Jesus is the lamp. Revelation 21 calls him the lamp by whose light the nations will walk someday. He's the light of the world. Jesus has the shining, blossoming crown. Of the increase of his government and of peace, there will be no end as he sits on the throne of David. And Jesus is great David's greater son. He's our only hope. He's where the presence of God is found. He's where forgiveness is found. He's the only one who can set the world right. And so, what I like about this psalm is I think it's telling us as we journey, like on the pilgrimage of the Christian life, what we ought to do is fix our eyes on Jesus. Keep our eyes on Jesus. And we can sing this song because this song is ultimately about him. It's fulfilled in him. Revelation 21 actually tells us that. I'll just close with these verses from Revelation 21. This is in the future for us. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them, presence as their God. And he who was seated on the throne, the horn, the lamp, the one with the blossoming, shining crown, he who was seated on the throne said, behold, I am making all things new. What a promise. Like, what promises we have in Jesus. He is immeasurably more than anything we could ever think or ask or imagine. He's so good. Let's thank him.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of Providence Church. For more resources and info, visit us online at www.providenceaustin.com.